Design Review Board meeting. Let's begin with roll call.
Carolyn Adams. Tim Olson.
Here.
Nolan Morgan. Brad Brown.
Here.
Scott Rosser.
Here.
Dave Russell.
Here.
Susan Bush.
Here.
All right. I don't think we have any meeting minutes or any previous business to wrap up. So first item on the agenda tonight is the Open Public Meeting Act, reviewing code of conduct and ethics rules, followed by a conceptual design conference for Continental Divide. But before we get into any of those, I don't think we have any members of the public here, but if there's anything that's not on the agenda that someone from the public would like to bring up. All right. Let's go ahead and dive in.
All right. My name is Prince Cowan. I'm the administrative supervisor in the planning and building department, and I'm just going to take a few minutes to talk about the training that you will be watching tonight. It's the Open Public Meetings Act training and the Public Records Act training. It is required of boards and commissions once every 4 years. And so we are just finishing up getting that completed this month. You all now have signed your code of conduct and code of ethics forms. So once we watch the two videos tonight, I will have you sign the certificate of training that is at your seat. And you can just leave that at your seats tonight, and staff will gather it up at the end of the night. We also just wanted to point out a few things. Design Review Board has their own Design Review Board email. It is posted on the Design Review Board page. The public can email the board at any time, so we ask that you be sure to use your assigned city email rather than your personal email accounts for all city business. If you need help getting your email signed up, if you haven't already started using it with your smartphones or iPads or just on your computer, you can contact our help desk. On first page of your packet and the staff memo, there is the email address and the phone number that you can contact, and they can help you over the phone to get things set up, or you can come in anytime and meet with one of them, and they can give you some hands-on training. The last page in your meeting packet is the What is a Record form, and that's just a reminder that all city documents are considered public record and are open to disclosure upon request, if there's ever a public records request. And that does include email. So if you are sending an email or if you put on your out-of-office reply, just be sure that it is, of course, contains language befitting a public official. And with that, I am just going to go ahead and start the first video. If no one has any other questions, the first one will be Open Public Meetings Act, and it's just under 17 minutes.
Hi, I'm Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson. Joining me in this video is our Open Government Assistant Attorney General, Nancy Creer. This training video provides an overview of the Open Public Meetings Act for both the general public and for public agencies. It is intended to provide a greater understanding of the legal requirements of this important act. The Open Public Meetings Act is a law passed by the people of the state of Washington in 1971, at the time of a nationwide effort to make government affairs more accessible and government more responsive. The purpose of the Act is to provide the public access to information concerning the conduct of state and local government. The law is based on the principle that open government is essential to a free society. The Act provided the people of our state the opportunity to witness the deliberations and the decisions of their government. State and local agencies, such as school boards, city and county councils, and state commissions, must comply with the Open Public Meetings Act. Actions and deliberations of these governing bodies must be conducted openly. Meetings subject to the Act must be open to the public gavel to gavel, unless a law permits a meeting or a part of the meeting to be closed. Thank you so much for watching, and I hope you find this training informative.
This training presentation is based on the Open Public Meetings Act. The OPMA is in RCW 42.30. This training video contains 15 short segments. The Attorney General just discussed Segment 1, the history, intent, and purpose of the Act. In the remaining segments, we will cover scope of the OPMA, what is a governing body, what is a meeting, what is action, what is final action, travel and gathering, regular meetings, special meetings, executive sessions, public attendance and comment, minutes, liability, other laws, and additional resources. The Act has several clear requirements, and compliance with them is improved with training. Training can mean the difference between complying with the law and expensive litigation. The Act applies to governing bodies of multi-member public agencies, both state and local. Public agency includes A, any state board, commission, committee, department, educational institution, or other state agency which is created by or pursuant to statute other than the courts and the legislature. B, any county, city, school district, special purpose district, or other municipal corporation or political subdivision of the state of Washington. C, any sub-agency of a public agency which is created by or pursuant to statute, ordinance, or other legislative act, including but not limited to planning commissions, library or park boards, commissions and agencies. And D, any policy group whose membership includes representatives of publicly owned utilities formed by or pursuant to the Washington laws when meeting together or on behalf of participants who have contracted for the output of generating plants being planned or built by an operating agency. In some cases, an entity which is not an agency can still be subject to the Act when it is the functional equivalent of a public agency. This determination depends on whether it performs a government function, receives government funding, the extent of government involvement or regulation, and whether the entity was created by government. Examples of public agencies subject to the Act include city councils, county councils, school boards, fire district boards, and state commissions. Agencies governed by an individual, such as a single director, are not subject to the Act. Some activities of public agencies are not subject to the OPMA. They include certain licensing and permitting activities, quasi-judicial matters, matters governed by the Washington State Administrative Procedure Act, APA, and certain collective bargaining activities. All meetings of the governing body of a public agency shall be open in public, and all persons shall be permitted to attend any meeting of the governing body of a public agency, except as otherwise provided in the OPMA. A governing body is defined as the multi-member board, commission, committee, council, or other policy or rulemaking body of a public agency, or any committee thereof, when the committee acts on behalf of the governing body, conducts hearings, or takes testimony or public comment. Meeting means meetings at which action is taken. Physical presence of the members is not required. A meeting can occur by phone, or in some cases by email. I will talk more about email exchanges later in this video. A meeting does not need to be titled meeting. The OPMA also applies to retreats, workshops, and study sessions. A meeting does not occur if there is not a quorum. Both actions and final actions are subject to the OPMA. Action means the transaction of the official business of a public agency by a governing body, including but not limited to receipt of public testimony, deliberations, discussions, considerations, reviews, evaluations, and final actions. Final action means a collective, positive or negative decision, or an actual vote by a majority of the members of the governing body when sitting as a body or entity upon a motion, proposal, resolution, order, or ordinance. Final actions must occur in public. Secret ballots are not allowed. A majority of the members of the governing body may travel together or gather for purposes other than a regular meeting or special meeting, so long as no action is taken. And remember, action includes discussion of agency business. This means a quorum of members can travel to a meeting together, or they can gather at a public or private event, such as a festival or social function, so long as they do not collectively discuss agency business or matters. Regular meetings are recurring meetings held in accordance with a periodic schedule by ordinance, resolution, bylaws, or other rule. State agencies file the notice of regular meetings each year with the Office of the Code Reviser. Special meetings are meetings that are not regular meetings, called by the presiding officer or a majority of the members. This means they are meetings not on a fixed schedule, such as on a day different than the regularly scheduled meetings. Certain notice requirements apply to special meetings. For example, 24-hour advance written notice must be provided to members of the governing body unless waived, provided to local newspapers, radio, and TV stations that have a request on file, posted on the agency's website if the agency has a website, unless other exceptions apply for agencies with few staff, and prominently displayed at the main entrance and the meeting site. The notice must specify the time, place, and business to be transacted. There is an exception to the notice requirements for emergency special meetings. Those are meetings involving injury or damage to persons or property, or the likelihood of injury or damage, where time requirements make notice impractical and increase likelihood of injury or damage. Under the OPMA, an executive session is a part of a regular or special meeting that is closed to the public for the limited purposes listed in the OPMA. The grounds for holding an executive session are narrowly construed. The purpose of the executive session and the time it will end must be publicly announced before excluding the public, and the time can be extended by further announcement. Examples of purposes include certain real estate discussions, reviewing negotiations on publicly bid contracts under certain conditions, evaluating the qualifications of an applicant for public employment, and meeting with legal counsel regarding enforcement actions, litigation, or potential litigation. The OPMA provides a list of authorized executive session purposes at RCW 42.30.110. In addition, a public agency can have a closed meeting to discuss matters not subject to the OPMA, such as deliberating on a quasi-judicial matter. Other laws may provide additional procedures or authority for particular meetings or hearings, or for particular agencies. An agency must carefully follow the law when meeting in an executive or closed session. For example, when meeting in an executive session under the OPMA to discuss agency enforcement actions, litigation, or potential litigation, there are three requirements. First, legal counsel representing the agency must be present. Second, the purpose is to discuss an agency enforcement action, litigation, or potential litigation to which the agency, governing body, or a member acting in an official capacity is a party or is likely to become a party. And finally, public knowledge regarding the discussion is likely to result in an adverse legal or financial consequence to the agency. Remember, an agency can discuss only those matters in an executive session under the OPMA that it has told the public it would discuss. The members cannot talk about other topics in that executive session. As we discussed, all meetings of the governing body of a public agency shall be open and public and all persons shall be permitted to attend any meeting of the governing body of a public agency, except as otherwise provided in the OPMA. An agency also cannot place conditions on attendance, such as requiring persons to register their names or fill out a questionnaire before attending. As noted, email or phone call discussions among members of a governing body can be a meeting under the OPMA. But the purpose of the OPMA is to permit the public to attend and observe agency meetings. So when the public is unable to attend email or phone call discussions that are meetings under the OPMA, the Act has been violated. For example, it is generally agreed that the members can meet via a teleconference call so long as, 1, any public notice procedures are satisfied, and 2, an agency sets up a process for the public to attend, such as having a speakerphone available at the agency's official meeting location so the public can hear the discussion. In contrast, since an email exchange among a quorum of members of a governing body is not open to the public, such an exchange in which action takes place is a meeting that would violate the OPMA. And remember again, action is broadly defined. Those email exchanges do not comply with public notice and attendance requirements for regular or special meetings. The OPMA does not include a requirement that public agencies allow public comment. Nevertheless, many public agencies do permit some public comment period at a meeting, such as at the beginning of a meeting. Agencies can put reasonable procedures in place to allow for public comment, and the OPMA has procedures for dealing with disruptions when the orderly conduct of the meeting is unfeasible. The OPMA is in RCW 42.30. A different law describes meeting minutes. That law is at RCW 42.32.030, and it says, "The minutes of all regular and special meetings, except executive sessions of such boards, commissions, agencies, or authorities, shall be promptly recorded, and such records shall be open to public inspection." That law does not require any specific format for minutes. That law also does not require an audio or video recording of a meeting, although many agencies make such recordings. We have advised that the minutes should, at a minimum, recite the significant actions of the agency. Violations of the OPMA can result in a lawsuit against an agency and its members. A court can impose a $100 civil penalty as personal liability against each member who knowingly violates the OPMA. A court can declare any action taken at a meeting not held in compliance with the OPMA null and void. And a court will award costs and attorney's fees to a successful party seeking a remedy under the OPMA. To recap, this presentation covers the highlights of the Open Public Meetings Act. Public agencies may be subject to other laws governing other particular meeting or hearing procedures or governing particular agencies. And the laws concerning agency meetings and hearings can also be amended from time to time. Therefore, agencies are cautioned to be mindful of all the current laws concerning their meeting and hearing procedures. For example, as of the date of this video, the 2014 legislature passed a new law amending the OPMA. That act will require regular meeting agendas to be placed online 24 hours before the meeting's start time, with certain limited exceptions. If the governor signs Substitute House Bill 2105, it will become effective June 12, 2014.
Thanks for participating in the Attorney General's Open Government Training. For more information, there are resources available for agencies to receive training and technical assistance for compliance with the Open Public Meetings Act. An official should first consult with its agency's counsel for routine assistance and for training. Additional resources are listed on this website. The Assistant Attorney General for Open Government, Nancy Creer, is also available to provide information about the Open Public Meetings Act.
So did the governor sign it?
The Open Public Meetings Act form, you mean? The certificate that is at your seats, the certificate of training. After you watch the second video, you can sign that sheet, and we can just take it for you at the end of the meeting. Before we start the Public Records Act training, I do also want to outline that over the summer, one of the meetings, Anya Mullen from the City Clerk's Office attended one of your Design Review Board meetings and handed out the Managing Retention in Microsoft Outlook. This is the email archiving process the city has undertaken. And so there are additional copies of the booklet you can look at any time. This is for the purpose of archiving or having folders for your emails that you might need to keep. And it also, in the booklet, outlines which emails are safe to delete. So definitely take a look at that when you have a chance. And I will start the second video.
Hi, I'm Bob Ferguson, your Attorney General. With me in this video is the Open Government Assistant Attorney General, Nancy Creer. This training video provides a basic overview of our Public Records Act for both records requesters and state and local agencies. It's intended to provide a greater understanding of the legal requirements around the Act. The Public Records Act is a law created by an initiative vote of the people in 1972, which provides the public access to the records of government agencies. It received 72% of the vote. The purpose of the Act is to provide the public full access to information concerning the conduct of government, mindful of individuals' privacy rights, and fulfill the desire for the efficient administration of government. The law is based on the principle that open government is essential to a free society. All state and local agencies must comply with the Public Records Act. All public records must be disclosed unless a law exempts records or information. There are well over several hundred exemptions. Some of those exemptions are listed in the Act, but many exist in other state and federal laws. The Act is a broad mandate interpreted in favor of disclosure, and its exemptions are narrowly construed.
This training presentation is based on the Public Records Act and the Attorney General's Advisory Model Rules. The rules are online at the Attorney General's website at www.atg.wa.gov. They provide examples of steps to comply with the Public Records Act. An agency may adopt any part of the model rules into its own rules. Local agencies should consult the model rules when establishing local Public Records Act ordinances. The model rules provide comments that are useful for interpreting the Public Records Act and for training agency personnel. The model rules are non-binding, but they are based on extensive outreach, court decisions, and have been cited favorably in some court cases. This training video was prepared in the fall of 2017. The model rules were being updated in 2017. The legislature also amended the Public Records Act in 2017, and the legislature can amend it again in the future. The courts can also interpret the Act. Consequently, and as a reminder, there may be developments in the law after this video was prepared. Several updates on the law are often posted in materials on the Attorney General's Office website on the Open Government Training page. A PowerPoint on that page also provides training on the Public Records Act. This training video contains 16 short segments where we will review history, purpose, and intent of the Public Records Act, scope of the PRA, general obligations of an agency, what is a public record, requests for records, initial agency responses, reasonable estimates, adequate searches, disclosure, electronic records, managing broad requests, exemptions and withholding, fees, other records provisions, liability, and finally, additional resources. You have just heard from the Attorney General about the history, purpose, and intent of the Act. The Act regulates the disclosure of public records. The Act requires disclosure of public records unless a law permits withholding of a record or part of a record. The Act has many components, and compliance requires training. Training can be the difference between a satisfied requester and expensive litigation. The Act applies to both state and local agencies. A state agency includes every state office, department, division, bureau, board, and commission. A local agency includes every county, city, town, municipal corporation, special purpose district, and other forms of local government. In some cases, an entity which is not an agency can still be subject to the Act when it is the functional equivalent of an agency. This determination depends on whether it performs a government function, receives government funding, the extent of government involvement or regulation, and whether the entity was created by government. Courts are not subject to the Act. Agencies must appoint a public records officer, responsible for being a point of contact for the public and for overseeing compliance. The name and contact information of the public records officer should be published with information on how to submit requests for records. The public records officer must have received training on the Act within 90 days of assuming his or her duties. Agencies must also publish information on the agency organization, rules, and procedures, and an index of specific categories of records. Agencies are required to adopt reasonable rules to provide full public access to public records, to protect public records from damage or disorganization, to prevent excessive interference with other essential functions of the agency, and to provide the fullest assistance to inquirers. Agencies may wish to consult with their attorneys when developing their rules and procedures. A public record is any writing relating to the conduct of government, which is prepared, owned, used, or retained by any state or local agency, regardless of physical form or characteristics. It could be an email, text message, paper, letter, or memo, an audio or video recording, a picture, image, map, or any recording of information or data compilation from which information may be obtained or translated. A public record is not just what an agency creates, but includes documents created by citizens or private companies that are used or received by a government for a governmental purpose. A public record may also include documents not possessed by the agency, but which were used by the agency. For example, the courts have described that work documents on the personal computer, personal cell phone, or personal email account of an agency employee or official are subject to a request under the Public Records Act. Records of certain volunteers are excluded from the definition of public record. Records are excluded when they are not otherwise required to be retained and are held by volunteers who do not serve in an administrative capacity, have not been appointed by the agency to an agency board, commission, or internship, and do not have a supervisory role or delegated agency authority. Any person wishing to inspect or copy public records of an agency should submit the request to the agency, preferably in writing, using the agency's request form. The Public Records Act doesn't prescribe any official format for a valid request, so an agency must honor valid requests for identifiable records regardless of the format of the request. While using an agency's form is not required, it is typically the most efficient way to submit a request. A requester who chooses not to use an agency form must give the agency fair notice that he or she is submitting a request for public records. Agencies are required to honor requests received in person during an agency's normal office hours or by email. If an agency has adopted reasonable rules on how requests should be submitted, the agency may rely on those rules. The agency should be helpful to the requester in explaining how a request should be submitted and to whom. Records shall be available for inspection and copying upon request for identifiable records. So requesters should give a reasonable description of the records, enabling the agency to search for potentially responsive records. A request for all or substantially all of an agency's records is not a proper request for identifiable records. A request regarding a particular topic or containing a particular keyword or name shall not be considered a request for all of an agency's records. A request for information is not the same as a request for public records. The Public Records Act does not apply to requests for information. There is no duty to create a record that does not exist in order to fulfill a request for records or information. However, requests for information are at times easier to fulfill. Fulfilling a request for information may avert a large public records request. An agency must promptly respond to public records requests. Within 5 business days of receiving a request, an agency must respond. An initial response may be any one of the following: acknowledging receipt of the request and providing a reasonable estimate to respond, or fulfilling the request, or providing an internet address and link to the records on the agency's website, or seeking clarification while also, to the greatest extent possible, providing an estimate of time for further response if the request is not clarified, or denying the request with an accompanying written statement of the specific reasons. Reasonably clear requests for identifiable records may require no clarification. However, some requests are unclear. Seeking clarification permits the agency to identify responsive records, which in turn will aid in determining the scope of the request. Clarifying a request provides the fullest assistance to the requester so that the requester receives and pays for only those copies that are desired. Clarification may also result in prompt disclosure by identifying only those records desired. An agency should not seek clarification if the request is for identifiable records and is reasonably clear. If the entire response is unclear and the requester fails to respond to the agency's request for clarification, the agency need not respond to it. However, the agency must respond to those portions of a request that are clear. An agency may deny a bot request, which is a request that was automatically generated by a computer program or script when it is one of multiple requests from the requester received within a 24-hour period. The agency must establish that responding to the bot request would cause excessive interference with other essential agency functions. A requester is typically not required to provide the reason for a request unless a law necessitates additional information from the requester. Agencies and requesters are encouraged to promptly communicate with each other if there are issues regarding a request. An agency's initial response to a public records request must provide a reasonable estimate for the time to respond when more time is needed. A reasonable estimate should account for many factors, including the time to have the requester clarify the request if needed, as well as time to assemble and review the records, provide notice to affected persons or agencies if needed, to redact exempt information, and to create a withholding or exemption log. An agency should not use the same estimate for every request. Rather, each reasonable estimate should be based on factors such as the complexity of the request, other pending requests, agency resources, and other agency essential functions. It's a good practice for an agency to briefly explain to the requester the basis for the estimate in the initial response. Extending the estimate is appropriate when circumstances have changed or additional information has come to light. Agencies are encouraged to briefly explain the need to revise an estimate. An agency bears the burden of showing that its search was adequate. Consequently, agencies should be able to document how a search was conducted and, for example, what search terms it used, as well as the location searched. An adequate search depends on the facts of each request, but it is one that is reasonably calculated to uncover all responsive documents in whatever form, paper or electronic. An agency must make more than a perfunctory search and follow obvious leads as they are uncovered. The search should not be limited to one or more locations if there are additional places where responsive records are likely to be found. If responsive public records are likely to be found on or in an agency employee's or official's personal device or account, the employee or official must search those devices and accounts for responsive records. It is possible to conduct an adequate search and still not locate a responsive document. However, if a responsive record is not located and/or if challenged in court, the agency will have to prove its search was adequate. An agency must make records available during its customary office hours for a minimum of 30 hours per week. Public records are presumed to be open for inspection and copying unless a specific law exempts the record or information from disclosure. Agencies can deliver copies of records to a requester in a number of ways, such as providing links to the records that are on the agency's website, providing paper copies of paper records or scanned copies of paper records by mail or making them available for pickup, or providing electronic records by various methods. You may recall that with respect to what is a public record, the Public Records Act does not distinguish between paper and electronic records. Most agencies create records in an electronic format. A copy of an electronic record should be produced in the requested electronic format if reasonably feasible. Translating a record into an alternative electronic format at the request of the requester, or scanning a paper record, is not creating a new record. Metadata is information embedded in a document that provides detail about the document's characteristics. This may include information such as when the document was created, edited, recipients, and so forth. Non-exempt metadata must be disclosed when expressly requested. When agencies obtain new technologies, they should consider not only the agency's business operation needs, but also records retention and disclosure requirements. Examples of such technologies are portals through which records can be requested and delivered, electronic redaction tools, or retention software, just to name a few. In addition, agencies can look at whether they could make use of their current technology more robust. The legislature encourages agencies to make public records widely available electronically, particularly commonly requested records. For example, an agency could make commonly requested records available on its website. Then, as noted earlier, an agency could fulfill its obligation to provide access to a public record by providing a requester with a link to a specific agency webpage containing the electronic copy of the requested record. For requesters without access to the internet, an agency could provide a computer terminal at its office. Agencies should develop policies addressing technology concerns, such as if and when agency employees may use personal devices for public agency uses, and what responsibilities and requirements therefore attach to the employee. An agency may receive a broad request that asks for any and all records related to a topic. Agencies may not deny a request solely because it is overly broad. As noted, a request for all or substantially all of an agency's records is not a valid request. But a request for all records regarding a particular topic or containing a particular keyword or name is not a request for all of an agency's records. After an initial search shows there are potentially hundreds or thousands of different types of responsive or potentially responsive records, a public records officer should contact the requester to explain the estimated total number of records that would need to be searched, or provide other information describing the anticipated scope of the search. Then the agency could seek clarification to ask if the requester wants all of the different types of responsive records and is willing to pay for all the copies, or instead, if the requester is seeking only some of the records. Good communication can assist both the agency and the requester. A broad request will usually result in a longer estimate of time for disclosure, as well as producing records in batches or installments. When seeking clarification, to the greatest extent possible, the agency must provide a reasonable estimate of time the agency will require to respond to the request if it is not clarified. In many instances, a requester will narrow the scope of the request to enable the agency to provide disclosure more promptly and less expensively. An agency may manage broad requests in a couple ways. An agency may require a deposit in an amount not to exceed 10% of the estimated cost of providing copies for a request. If an agency makes copies in response to a request available on a partial or installment basis, the agency may charge for each part of the request as it is provided. If an installment of a records request is not claimed or reviewed, the agency is not obligated to fulfill the balance of the request. Finally, use of electronic technologies to search, review, redact, and disclose public records can reduce overall costs of compliance for agencies. Agency responses denying in whole or in part inspection or copy of any public record shall include a statement of the specific exemption authorizing the withholding of the record and a brief explanation of how the exemption applies. Exemptions exist throughout the Public Records Act and other state and federal laws. Common exemptions include information such as personal information in files maintained for agency employees, if private, pending investigative files compiled by law enforcement or agencies with authority to discipline members of a profession, the non-disclosure of which is essential to effective law enforcement or for the protection of any person's right to privacy, educational records of students in public schools, attorney-client privilege information or work product related to litigation, or protected healthcare information. There is no statute providing a general privacy exemption. If privacy is an express element of a specific exemption, it is only invaded if disclosure would be both highly offensive to the reasonable person and also not of legitimate concern to the public. Exemptions in the Act must be construed narrowly. The general rule is that an agency redacts or withholds only the exempt information and produces the non-exempt information. An acceptable way of providing this information to the requester is with a withholding index, often called an exemption log. The information provided as part of the log should include a description of the type of record or part of record denied. The description should include identifying information from the document. For example, whether the document is a letter or email, the date the document was created or other relevant date, the total number of pages, and the sender and recipients. The exemption log must also include the statutory authority making the information exempt and a brief explanation of how the exemption applies. Some of this information will be evident on the face of the document where redactions have been made to only part of the document. An exemption log, the written explanation, also may be provided in different formats. For example, may be handwritten or compiled in a spreadsheet or chart, or in a letter, or redactions are marked on the records with exemption codes, and the requester is given the key to the codes. The format of the exemption log or exemptions is not relevant so long as the required information is provided. Any person may inspect non-exempt public records for free. An agency may not charge for the time of staff to search, review, or redact public records when preparing them for inspection. If a requester wants copies of records, an agency has options to charge for copies. It can charge actual costs, or it can charge default fees listed in the Public Records Act, or it can charge an alternative up to $2 fee for an entire request. Some other provisions may be relevant too. In order to charge actual costs, an agency must make available for public inspection and copying a statement of the actual per page or other costs and how it determined actual costs. An agency may adopt its statement of actual costs only after providing notice and a public hearing. When calculating fees, the agency must use the most reasonable, cost-efficient method available to the agency. Staff time to copy and deliver the requested public records may be included in an agency's costs, but an agency may not include staff salaries, benefits, or other general administrative or overhead charges unless those costs are directly related to the actual cost of copying the public records. An example of when an agency may want to charge for the actual cost of staff time is where an agency scans paper records and copies them into an electronic format. The charges should be reasonable and related to the wage of the person likely to be repeatedly assigned to this task. If an agency does not have staff available to make copies, for non-exempt records, an agency may send a scanning or copying project to an outside vendor and pass on the actual cost to the requester. Electronic copy costs may include the actual cost of the electronic production or file transfer of the record, the use of any cloud-based data storage processing service, and the cost of transmitting electronic records, including the use of a physical media device. A second method to charge copy costs is for an agency to choose to use a statutory default fee schedule provided in the Act. In that case, an agency need not calculate actual costs if it has rules or regulations declaring the reasons doing so would be unduly burdensome. The statutory default fee schedule lists, for example, per-page costs for paper records, scanned records, and costs for electronic records. As yet another alternative, an agency can assess an up to $2 flat fee for an entire request when certain conditions are met. The Act includes other fee provisions. For example, an agency cannot charge for access to or downloading of records it routinely posts on its website prior to the receipt of a request, unless the requester has specifically asked that the agency provide records through other means. An agency may impose the actual cost of a customized service charge when the request would require the use of IT expertise to prepare data compilations, or when such customized access services are not used by the agency for other business purposes. The agency must notify the requester and take other steps if it chooses to do a customized service. An agency can require an advance 10% deposit before making copies. An agency may enter into a contract, memorandum of understanding, or other agreement with a requester for an alternative fee arrangement, or in response to an extensive or frequently occurring request. An agency may choose to waive any charge pursuant to agency rules and regulations. Upon request, an agency must provide a summary of the applicable charges before making copies. The requester then may choose to revise the request to reduce the number of copies and the cost. In sum, the Public Records Act provides an agency several options for assessing charges for copies. The choices selected may vary from agency to agency. Under a different law, the records retention laws at RCW 40.14, agencies must maintain a log of public records requests, including for each request, the identity of the requester if provided, date of receipt, text of request, description of records produced, description of records redacted or withheld and the reasons for doing so, and the date of final disposition. With respect to the identity of the requester, it is possible an agency received only an email address from the requester, and if so, that address would be included in the log. The logs must be retained per the agency's records retention schedule and are a public record. The records retention law also provides that agencies spending at least $100,000 to fulfill requests during the prior fiscal year must report 17 data points about their PRA requests to the Joint Legislative Audit and Review Committee. Under the Public Records Act, any person having been denied an opportunity to inspect or copy a public record may seek further review in the agency. The person may also file a lawsuit to enforce his or her right to access public records. A requester can also file a lawsuit if he or she believes that an agency has not made a reasonable estimate of the time or of the charges to provide public records. Such a lawsuit is to be filed in a court within 1 year of an agency's final definitive response to a request, such as a final claim of exemption or the last production of public records on an installment basis. The agency has the burden of proof to demonstrate that public records were lawfully denied or its estimates were reasonable. If it does not make this showing, an agency will pay the requester's reasonable attorney's fees and costs, and may pay potential penalties for denying records in violation of the Public Records Act. A court will consider mitigating and aggravating factors in determining a penalty amount. Lawsuits for public records can be extremely time-consuming and expensive for agencies. Understanding and correctly applying the law is a good risk management tool for state and local government. In rare cases, individual employees may also be civilly or criminally liable under other laws. State agency employees and state officers are subject to the Ethics in Public Service Act. It is a violation of that state ethics law for a state employee or officer to intentionally conceal a public record required to be released under the Public Records Act. State agency employees and officers may be fined up to $5,000 per violation of the state ethics law. It's also a crime for any agency officer to willfully mutilate, destroy, conceal, erase, obliterate, or falsify any record of that agency's office, except where the law expressly authorizes the non-disclosure or destruction of records. The crime is punishable by imprisonment of up to 10 years or a fine of up to $5,000 or both.
Thank you for participating in the Attorney General's Open Government Training. For more information, there are available resources for agencies to receive training and technical assistance for compliance with the Public Records Act. An employee should first consult with its agency's public records officer for routine assistance or training. Additional resources are listed on this website. The Assistant Attorney General for Open Government is also available to provide information about the Public Records Act. Thanks again for watching.
All right, and that is it. Are there any questions? Okay, thank you.
I'm Andy.
Hi.
You too?
Yeah.
I have a PDF.
Okay.
It's not a bad idea.
Oh, that's pretty good timing.
Yeah, right on. Right on the dot.
All right.
Perfect. Good.
Is that it? So there's no more? No. No more ethics.
All right, if we're all settled in, I think the next item on the agenda is the Conceptual Design Conference for Continental Divide.
All right, thank you.
Sorry, Tony, yeah, take it away.
All right, thank you. Tony Levitt, representing the Planning Department. Yes, this is the Continental Divide Mixed Use Project, file DRV 17-00643. So the site is located at 8505 132nd Avenue Northeast. It actually consists of 8 existing parcels that are zoned Rose Hill Business District 8 zoning. The site is bordered to the west by 131st Avenue Northeast, to the east by 136th Avenue Northeast, to the south by Northeast 85th, and to the north is multiple parcels that are zoned single-family residential. The site currently contains multiple single-family residents and associated accessory structures. All existing structures will be demolished as part of the proposal. The majority of the site is relatively flat with only significant grade in the southeast corner of the site. The applicant is proposing the construction of two elements. First is the single-story commercial building, which are located along 85th Street. They range in size depending on the three schemes that they have, but around 7,500 square feet is what they're looking at. Three-story residential buildings would be located behind that with one level of below-grade parking, looking at proposal of around 133 units. Vehicular access is depending on the site design. I will note that during the pre-submittal stage for the project, the Public Works Department did have a note that any driveways along 132nd Avenue or 131st Avenue shall be located a minimum 150 feet north of the intersection with 85th measured from the face of curb. Also, they said that no driveways would be allowed from 85th Street. Obviously, the final design will be reviewed as part of the applicant's design response conference application, but I wanted to note that today. The applicant has provided you with three massing and site design options. So, for your review tonight, some of the key zoning regulations that apply. First, permitted uses, commercial, office, residential, stacked are allowed on the site. Residential is restricted from the ground floor. As I noted in my memo, we have had a discussion with the applicant about options for allowing ground floor residential. So one option would be a PUD approval needed before to allow that to occur. That would need to occur following the design review board approval and prior to submittal of the building permits.
Could the applicant just split his site up in the two parcels and get around this?
No, there's some provisions. It gets into some provisions within the zoning code that require that these lots to be all consolidated into one. Mostly, and the issue is really, it's not really long 85th, it's long 132nd and 131st. That's kind of the areas they feel that the commercial use would not work. So that's where there's some, like I say, the kind of the way the code was written, there's some things that would, some other issues that would pop up if they tried to divide this item. Some other things, design regulations are concerned. So height is maximum, building height is 35 feet above average building elevation, except the height is limited to 30 feet within 30 feet of a RSX zone, which is the northern edge of the site. The ground floor of all structures on the subject property also shall be a minimum of 15 feet in height. Additionally, setbacks are 10 feet from Northeast 85th Street front property line, 20 feet from 132nd and 131st front property lines, and the rear is a 15-foot setback. The DRB does have the ability to approve required yard setback minor variations. Additionally, the site would be subject to affordable housing requirements. So tonight, some of the things we want to take a look at as far as scale, we'll go into the details here, but some of the discussion points are what are some of the key advantages of the project, identify appropriate mitigation techniques for building massing, possible techniques include vertical and horizontal modulation, corner treatment, roof forms, et cetera. We'll look at the pedestrian orientation. How does the proposed massing and location of the structure relate or correspond to the pedestrian environment? What are some of the key pedestrian connections, and how would the project engage pedestrians? Additionally, we'll want to look at landscaping. What are some opportunities for landscaping and open space on the subject property? I did note, so this is actually a entry gateway to the city. So that's something also we'll want to take into account as we get further down the line with the design of the corner at 85th and 132nd. Additionally, does the DRB have any preliminary feedback on the potential minor variations to the required yards along 85th Street? So tonight, again, we'll want you to provide guidance on the applicant's massing and site design options, provide feedback on setback variations proposed by the applicant, and finally determine what models, drawings, perspectives, et cetera, and other application materials the applicant will need to submit with the design response application. So with that, I will pass it over to the applicant.
Oops.
right.
Tony, could we turn some of the lights off in front of the screen?
Yeah.
Oh.
And does this screen not work?
Thanks.
Yes, it does work.
It does.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you.
Okay. My name's Andy Hoyer. I'm with Encore Architects. And again, we're looking at the site that's located on 85th, about 2 miles directly west of here, between 131st and 132nd. This is right on the border between Kirkland and Redmond, and it is zoned RH8. Again, I'm with Encore Architects. We are located in Seattle. I've been doing multifamily housing for the past 30 years, and this is actually my first project in Kirkland, but our firm has done a couple already. So the current site right now, which is located on this colored in there, doesn't work. Right now, 85th is the main commercial street. Right now, it is developed kind of sporadically all along 85th. The Rose Hill design guidelines really see this as a stronger commercial frontage all along 85th, and then changing to more residential as we get to the north of the site. So this is the Rose Hill Business District Design Guidelines diagram. You can see 85th is really planned as a commercial corridor throughout the Rose Hill District. And a special interest is that green buffer zone that's there to minimize the impact on residential areas. And you'll notice that on our site, that buffer is located on the south side of the site, which makes one think that the north side of the site would be that residential that we're creating that buffer from. So this is just some shots of the current kind of commercial spaces that are on 85th right now. These are all located within the general vicinity of our site. The one on the top left is directly across the street. Starting looking at the site with just some of those few design guidelines in our minds of having that commercial corridor along 85th, creating the buffer to the residential, creating a gateway on the corner of 85th and 132nd, starting to look at how we would diagram this site. There is actually quite a bit of grade change between the southwest corner on the lower left and the northeast corner on the upper right. There is approximately 10 feet of grade change across there, and approximately 4 or 5 feet of grade change along 131st from 85th going north. So we're going to take advantage of that grade and really look at how the parking is located under the building so that we can put those residential structures above that. And that, so on the north side, the parking structure is the ground floor structure, and as the ground comes up, it's still the ground, the residential is still above grade, and it's all dependent on what that definition of a ground floor is. So the first thing we wanted to do is line 85th with commercial space, so doing about a 30 to 40 foot depth of commercial space, putting that straight up front. In the design, Rose Hill design guidelines, one of the options is to reduce that 10-foot front setback to zero if we want to, as long as we have a pedestrian-friendly facade along that street and that we have entrances into that commercial space from that street. So that's one thing that we would like to take advantage of to make that feel like a stronger design corridor. The other thing is that our south property line is kind of jigging and jogging a little bit due to the various street vacations that have happened along there. So we want to create a consistent frontage along that face. In terms of setbacks, we're required a 20-foot setback on
131st and 132nd required a 15-foot setback against the residential to the north. Really think that that's probably a little tight, and we really want to have that 30-foot buffer all the way across the site, allowing us to keep a consistent height. Our height limit's at 35 feet from the average grade. So we want to create that 30-foot buffer, make that a landscape buffer that's an amenity for the residents on this site, and just create that that wider buffer to the single-family residential to the north. With the commercial frontage along 85th, we want to make sure that we have appropriate office and guest parking that's conveniently located to that, and doing that as surface parking that is hidden by the commercial space, putting that back behind. And again, that is the preferred option in the design, the Rose Hill design guidelines. We had communication with the transportation department, and they clarified their requirements of where the curb cuts are allowed. Since 131st is considered a residential street, I think that's not quite the right term, but he used a term that's a minor street. So we're allowed to have that curb cut 75 feet from the curb. However, on 132nd, which is a much busier street, we are required to be 150 feet back for that curb cut measured from the tangent of the curb. So what we would like to do is then fill the rest of that space with residential and have that be the buffer between the transition space, really, between the commercial frontage on 85th and the residential zone to the north. We want to have the access to that parking separate from the residential access, just so that there isn't confusion. And we'll have a partially below grade parking garage that'll have a security on it. We want to make sure that there is the ability to have a different driveway entrance that is specifically for the office and visitors to come to this project. One of the issues with 132nd, it's a very busy street. It gets a lot of backup traffic during rush hours. We think that it might be advantageous to have a second residential entrance to this project in case that area is so backed up that you can't even pull into your driveway. So we're really looking at that as a secondary entrance off of 131st. So finally, what we at looking at that site with that very simple diagram is trying to say, okay, then how can we make a strong residential entry to this project? How can we create the green space for this project? So our thought is to connect the bus stop back to the residential lobby, putting that residential lobby right in the center of that courtyard so that your pedestrian entry sequence is this nice walkway through the commercial space, coming from the bus stop, opening into a courtyard, and then getting to that lobby, having those units ringing that open space, using the residential building itself to screen the parking from view from 132nd. So that gets us to our preferred scheme, and that's generally how we have that laid out right now. And we'll go through the three different options that we looked at ahead of this scheme just to see if what other options we had. So that first option is kind of an H-shaped scheme, which puts the commercial in the front. It has the parking located in the center of the project, and then pulling back that center bar from the residential to give more modulation on that north side.
But you can't use the access.
Exactly. Right.
So that wasn't a legitimate option.
We came up with this option before we had the meeting with the transportation department. And in the Rose Hill guidelines, it says you could have parking on 85th, but after we talked to the transportation department, they said we couldn't have any off of 85th. Option B is an E-shaped building, taking that commercial space in the front and conglomerating it into one larger office space, having the parking located behind it, creating two smaller residential courtyards. And finally, the third option, which is that option C, creating that courtyard. And I think this one meets our goals the best of wanting to create a pedestrian-oriented facade along 85th, creating that gateway element on the southeast corner, having that residential entry visible from the street and having that good pedestrian entry sequence into that central courtyard. The landscape works better with this larger courtyard, and I'll show you that in the plans. Keeping that 30-foot buffer to the residential to the north, and parking is screened from the street, both from 132nd and from 85th. So this first scheme, again, has that H-shaped bar. And our first thought on this inclination was just to take that center bar and give that more space to the residential to the north. Claiming those two corners for the commercial spaces, really emphasizing those corners, and then putting the parking in the center. And obviously the disadvantages of this is the parking becomes the focal point of this courtyard. After meeting with transportation, we're not allowed to have the curb cut off of that street. So if we wanted to do an option like this, we'd have to do a cut through the building somehow to have that residential, not that residential, but that office parking and the visitor parking accessible. It also, in plan, it splits the open space up, right? So you have that southern courtyard, which is great to have that south-facing courtyard, but it's filled with the parking, and the units themselves are really looking at that parking. The courtyard itself becomes this very small area, even though we have that 30-foot buffer, which would be a landscaped amenity on the north side. It really does split up those spaces rather than keeping them as one large space. So the next option we looked at, well, again, was consolidating the commercial space along 85th, keeping an open corner on 131st, having the parking for the commercial located between the residential and the office space in the front, creating two smaller residential courtyards that are facing south, and maintaining the modulation on the north side, as you can see on the upper left drawing. Having that a very modulated facade, but keeping it, again, back that 30 feet. And on the south side, creating these two smaller courtyards, perhaps having that the central lobby right in the center. But looking at this scheme, it has some certain disadvantages. The parking's very inefficient. It becomes a single-loaded parking lot. Goes all the way through the site, really separates any kind of pedestrian entry that we could create into the site. The courtyards themselves become pretty tight. The units will be looking at each other. That's probably a 45 to 50 foot courtyard. It feels a little tight in there to make that pleasant. Because of our lot coverage, we can't do the office space, the commercial space, all the way across the front. We have the opportunity to have that great open landscape corner there, but I feel that this loses the ability to hold that corner and really create that presence all the way along 85th.
So you said because of the lot coverage, what did you mean by that?
We're allowed 70% lot coverage on this site.
Thank you.
And just doing the math.
And that includes parking?
And fitting the parking in, yes. So I have approximately 26 stalls, surface stalls available, so that limits the size of the commercial space that I can make. So back to the preferred option, is creating that strong commercial presence, you know, pretty consistently all the way along 85th. And this is more in keeping in scale with the commercial spaces that are across the street, which are broken up into smaller parcels. And then in between those two commercial spaces, having a pedestrian plaza in between them. That also provides direct access to the bus stop that is located right in front. Gives that pedestrian pathway straight to the back to the lobby. Really defines that space between the commercial and the residential, creating that buffer space between the two, creating one large courtyard that faces south rather than breaking it up into smaller pieces. So again, on the upper left side, looking at this, how this mashing would work, keeping that 30-foot landscape buffer, which will be that residential amenity for the entire entire residential community, creating that buffer to the north. You can see the courtyard in the lower drawing, how that would be ringed by the residential. They'd be able to have private patios that face onto that courtyard. The entry sequence between the two office buildings coming into the site really has a reason, strong presence to it. The parking itself is a little bit more efficient here, keeping that as tight in as I can. Again, keeping about 25 to 26 spaces on there as we need for the commercial space. And then having the residential ring all the way around. So the upper floors, again, just keeping that modulation on all three sides, all four sides, really. Having that south-facing courtyard. The parking is all located in a semi-below-grade parking garage. Again, thinking of the two entrances, one off of 132nd, which would work most of the time and is probably the most efficient to use. But again, if there is a lot of traffic, having a secondary exit that would work off of 131st. So in section, the top section is an east-west section looking towards the north. So you can see how on the west side, the grade's higher. On the east side, it's much lower along 132nd. So these residential units are really not ground floor units. They're above the ground floor. They're lifted up off of that ground floor, keeping the parking down low, keeping that hidden from view, screening it with walls and landscaping. That 20-foot landscape buffer on either side will screen that. The lower section is an east-west, north-south section looking towards 132nd. So putting the office space and lifting that up, keeping that an isolated object allows us to meet the sidewalk grade where we hit that sidewalk grade, using the lid of the parking garage for the courtyard and the guest and visitor parking for the office space. Having that parking garage drop down below grade, you can see on the north side, which is on the left of that drawing, is pretty much all the way above grade. So those units are held up. They're not really on the ground floor. They're up 8 to 10 feet from that north side. So looking at the design guidelines, there's a few that we're keeping in mind as we're going to develop the project to the next step. First one is the gateway. This is a requirement to have that as a gateway element as you're coming in from Redmond into Kirkland. So what that office space will look like at that corner is doing something to sculpt it. It might not be exactly like this, but this is the direction that is shown in the design guidelines. Whether it's exactly this form or not, we don't know yet. But we want to make sure that that is a strong element on that corner. It's holding that corner and has that presence to create that gateway in there. So, again, the commercial frontage along 85th, if it's a pedestrian-friendly facade, we're allowed to pull that closer to 85th. So we have some ideas of how that could work. These office spaces could be glassy space that has awnings, weather protection along 85th. Creating that center plaza in between those two buildings. That center plaza leads directly back to that main lobby behind it. Having the office parking and guest parking come off of 131st, which is a much slower street that allows us to have that curb cut that makes the most sense to serve those buildings up in front. So finally, just looking at that pedestrian experience as you're coming from the bus stop between the two office buildings, walking through that central courtyard to that main lobby with the office buildings flanking both sides, holding each corner strong, I think is a very strong scheme and seems like the best way to orient this with having the landscape facing south, keeping that courtyard as bright and sunny and available to the residents as possible. And as we go look to the next step of the project of what materials we're going to use, we know that we will be breaking up the project into a variety of different materials. We don't know what those materials are yet, but we're going to take a look at opportunities to really break down that scale and also our next step is really looking at the modulation on all four sides of this project. The office buildings in the front really create a nice modulation along 85th. They have the opportunities, again, to meet the corners, to create that central plaza landscaping. And as we develop the units and the unit plans themselves, we'll look at how those that modulation can be done on all three sides of that residential building and inside the courtyard to make sure that those units feel residential in scale, that they relate to the single-family residences to the north, creating balconies for these units, looking at pitched roof forms along the way. But since at this point we're just looking at the massing and the access, that's there. And I think that's the end of that.
Any questions?
I kind of have a couple. The zoning code requires 15-foot ground floor height.
Yes.
And it looks like you're looking at more like 10 to 13.
So the 15-foot ground floor requirement exempts stacked apartment buildings and parking garages.
Yes, resident. Yeah, but then so there's that's kind of the would be part of the PUD element or of some kind of variance from that because the obviously the residential is not allowed on the ground floor, so it's kind of a
two variances interesting. In one.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting.
Well, it specifically says if it's a 15-foot ground floor requirement, except for stacked dwelling units and parking garages.
Yeah, so. If we didn't require the retail on there, the variance is approved, then obviously they wouldn't have to have a 15-foot height.
Mm-hmm. Other thing I was curious about, so the Rose Hill guidelines and the pedestrian-friendly pedestrian streetscape, how does the city view office in that?
The zone doesn't, this isn't a zone that has retail as a requirement, it's just commercial for that frontage, so it could be office or retail.
And
so
it's,
I have a question on that one. Does that include their leasing office for the building?
That doesn't look to me like the intent would be for the leasing office to be in the...
That is not the intent. And it's also not a design variance to have that with going to the property line. It says in the Design Hill guidelines that we can build to the property line with a pedestrian-friendly free facade.
No, if they meet the pedestrian-friendly guidelines, they can go to zero. So it's not a variance that we grant in that respect.
We can approve minor variations if they request, but
we're not requesting.
I don't see any requests for it.
Is there something shown on the west commercial building? Was that encroaching into the 20-foot setback?
Actually, that's a good question.
Actually, so what I'm seeing is the applicant's preferred option requires a minor variation to the required yard along Northeast 85th Street.
So I'm assuming. Since I didn't write that, I'm assuming that was from
you. Yeah. Well, so that's the interesting thing, because the zoning code requires the 10-foot, but as you stated, the design guidelines, if they meet the certain requirements, they can push that up to zero. So, but it would still be, to meet the zoning code requirement, it would still be minor variation, even though they're complying with the design guidelines. Kind of a weird...
Yeah.
Okay.
Kind of little detail there. But again, I mean, what's one of the key things to approve minor variation is, you know, it meets design guidelines. So mm-hmm. I don't think we'd run into an issue there.
Okay, and then I guess the last thing, and this is a lot of this is just trying to understand the intent of the Rose Hill design guidelines. Is it the diagrams show that I'm trying to understand this buffer zone along maybe Fifth, because as applicant diagrammed, we have the uses along 85th are defined as being a buffer for the residential zone behind, and yet it's a low-rise frontage with a larger building between that low-rise frontage and the low-rise residential. And is that meeting the intent of the guidelines?
So the design guidelines do state that this is appropriate for low-scale residential.
Yeah.
They encourage low-scale residential. They're encouraging us to do low-income, which are requiring us to do low-income for 10%. So there's clearly the intent to provide residential in the language, which I don't remember right off the top of my head, but there is language in there that they do want residential on the north side of that zone.
Yeah. Yeah, the interesting thing is the so the design guidelines were, you know, they're from 2006. This was a rezone that was done, I don't know, a couple years ago. They kind of expanded the RH8 zone. So it's kind of that, yeah. So it's not directly, you know, reflected in the design guidelines, but that was the intent.
I mean, we don't see a lot of, haven't seen a lot of projects along this corridor yet. And yeah. So it's somewhat new to us in terms of where we would be.
Sure.
I have a couple on the, especially the pedestrian entrance. How wide is that between the two commercial buildings?
Between the two commercial buildings? I don't know off the top of my head. If I look really close, it looks to be about 40 feet. But I'm not, you know, again, we're still in the early phases, but 40 feet seems like an appropriate size. Yeah. If I could zoom in here, which I don't know if I can.
One of the site plans says 74 feet.
Between the two buildings?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it looks bigger than 40 feet.
I'm looking at,
you're right. I'm looking at a different dimension.
Either page
that's of the landscape portion between
38,
it.
Whichever one. Yeah. Yeah.
So, yes, it's about 75 feet.
And what are you sitting at in terms of lot coverage right now?
We're right at the 70%.
Any particular thinking about how wide those buildings should be apart versus moving the west building closer?
Is that a question to me?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. it could certainly, yes. I mean, I think we have to study that to see what's really the appropriate width for that, and we're open to your guidance of what you think is appropriate for that width. One of the things that I was trying to do is really capture that other corner to make sure that's a strong corner as well.
And you are at 35 feet above building?
Yes. So the residential portion is 35 feet above the average grade.
Can I ask one? Here's your gateway. So how far back are you going in that commercial building? And then it looks like you're going up two stories with residential above that.
Yeah, so let's see if I can find this section now that I've gotten out of design mode here. There we go. So there's a couple things that are interesting around here. So on the west side of the site, that's about 4 feet higher than the corner at 132nd. So those two buildings will be at different heights so that they meet the sidewalk appropriately. So this section shows us meeting the street, that 15-foot height which may be higher. We might go higher than that, but the 15 feet is the requirement for that commercial zone on the right. Kind of meets halfway through that second floor, right? And then we'll step back the building above it. One thing that I'm concerned about in looking at the design of the project is really how these two... sorry about that. And let's see, I'm going to go back one more. Of really how this corner resolves itself. Right now, I don't think it's very well resolved at how those two buildings meet each other, of whether that apartment, whether the residential portion should come forward a little bit over the top of the commercial space to make a stronger presence along that side. But that's something that we'll need to explore as we go along.
Are those buildings required to be contiguous in order for this to not be in our treated as an RSX? Like, do these have to touch?
They do not.
No.
Why is the office so low?
Because it's basically a zoning diagram. And since I know that the zoning diagram says I have to have a minimum of 15, I just showed it at 15 at this point. They can certainly get taller. I mean, for an office building, we have to find what the appropriate height for that is. But at this point, I'm really showing it mainly as a zoning diagram that says this has to be a minimum of 15 feet tall.
So what's stopping you from melding the commercial and the residential together to make a true mixed-use project?
Go back to the section. So one thing that I would like, just as I was just saying, is I do think it might be appropriate to take that the wing that's on the right and pull that over the top of the commercial space to make that feel more like a stronger building and actually create a stronger corner at that point. The thing that's preventing this from becoming a typical like 5-1 or 5-2 or 2-1 is really the height of this building. It wants to meet the street pretty high up here. Yeah. So when I get 15 feet above that, I'm halfway through this second floor. So really my only opportunity to pull over the top of that is with the top floor of this residential portion. So I really can't pull any other floors above it. I could just do it with that one story to create that stronger presence on the corner.
All of the commercial parking on this surface parking lot?
Yes.
Can you go to that preferred scheme site plan? It's on either page 32 or 38. I'm not sure which. It looks like your page 32. That one right there. So with that jiggity-jog property line on 85th, you're still not coming out to the property line, or is this awnings and other elements that will go out to extend closer to the zigzag property lines?
It's a good question. Right now we're showing them in the same plane. I don't think they need to be in the same plane. I think the building on the right can pull closer to the property line. I think that's something that's... It seems a little odd to me to do that. I think what we want to have is a consistent pedestrian zone all the way along that front so that it feels like that sidewalk's very wide at the corner of 132nd. It doesn't seem to make sense to have a smaller pedestrian zone on that stronger corner and then get to a smaller pedestrian zone as I go towards the west. So really it's just the landscape... continuity all the way along the front. We want to make sure that that feels like one consistent project and one consistent street frontage rather than moving that building forward. Instead of moving the building forward, I would push the sidewalk back.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, and that sidewalk's the stuff that's just been recently redone, and it actually currently has a kind of
retaining guard, because it falls off that residence that's right there at the corner.
Right.
Quite a ways down.
So there's quite a bit of grade drop right in here.
Yeah.
Right? So it drops down 4 to 6 feet, I think.
Yeah.
Right along this frontage, especially at this corner here. So we really want to raise that building up so that we're muting the sidewalk.
The section kind of shows it down, unless
it shows
I'm...
Shows it down, yeah.
Unless yeah. I'm... I don't... There's no... target elevation dots for what that office
but we
level
we would so there's a few things that we're going to have to balance, right? Is mm-hmm. the sidewalk grade here is
yep.
here is 4 feet lower than this sidewalk grade, so we want to make sure that that feels consistent along there, and then the floor level of these two buildings will have to meet ADA requirements, so I want to make sure that I can get this floor level low enough that I can get ADA access into the back of the building. And that could be done by internal ramping with inside the building, but we have to make sure that we work that out and make sure that all works together with the grades.
So are you saying there's a chance that your floor of that office would be below sidewalk grade?
It may be below sidewalk grade at this location. You'd have to. It might be below sidewalk grade here, but we would meet sidewalk grade at the corner where it's the most important to meet the sidewalk grade. And again, just to keep a consistent floor height, we would have to do that. We have to pick some place that's either going to be slightly above or slightly below grade at some point within that building.
Well,
I'd have to.
So option one, we know, has a code issue.
Yes.
Option two, is that a fully code compliant scheme?
So to make option one fully code compliant, what I would do is have the driveway come through the building to get to that parking lot.
Have you considered putting the commercial parking within the project, within the structure instead of surface lot?
So yes, we considered that as well. So the issues with putting it on a different level is the pedestrian pathway that creates, and also the difference. So I would have to create an elevator to get from the parking up to the project. I would also have to figure out a way to segregate the parking that's the commercial parking from the residential parking. I'd have to make sure that the entrance to that parking is obvious and visible. And really what I would rather do is the entrance to the parking garage become less obvious and less obtrusive on the street. So that's the main reason why I'm segregating those two parking zones. So
that it should be located to the sides or rear and not in front of the building.
So there's three options that are shown in the design guidelines, and there's a couple of them on this sheet. If you look through the design guidelines, there's three options that are presented about where to locate the parking. The preferred option is to have a pedestrian-friendly street with the parking behind it, like we're showing now. The second preferred option is to pull the commercial space back 10 feet and have landscape in front of it, have the parking behind the buildings or between the buildings. The third option that's shown in the design guidelines is to have the parking in front on the street with the commercial in the back. And that's shown in this diagram here.
Somewhat, the guideline says encourage development to locate and orient buildings toward the street with parking to the sides or rear.
It's encouraged, but they do show the last option, the third option, least preferred, being the parking on the street.
I think the third option, though, is when you have a street that has parking.
So, this is the diagram that's in the design guidelines, showing a 10-foot landscape buffer, with parking in the street, with pedestrian walkway to the commercial beyond. So it's certainly our preference to have the pedestrian-friendly street, right? We want to take that commercial building and bring it straight up to the sidewalk.
Tony and Jeremy, ABE calcs on something like this with essentially two separate buildings. Are there two separate ABE calcs and the one big building combined together gets one single ABE calculation?
I don't know if we've looked at that yet. There are probably different ways to do it. I mean, the commercial building on the southwest corner probably has its own standalone ABE, and then whether or not you calculate you could include the commercial building in the southeast corner in the ABE for the rest of the residential component.
Okay.
Or you probably could segregate it with a.
The different methods for ABE calc, it's probably their benefit to do one big one because in least rectangle approach rather than average midpoints, because then they get, you know, advantage to all of that height that's
the high side
on 85th for the. Do we know what the I'll call it the facade height on the north side is? I mean, I can kind of guess from the sections.
You mean from grade?
Yeah, from grade. It's
probably
obviously.
It's close to 40. Well, on this corner, it'll be close to 40 feet. On this corner, it'll be about, 35 plus 10. So 45 feet. On this corner, it'll be roughly 40 feet.
Okay. Brett, that's all I have.
All my questions were already asked, too. Does anyone have any other questions, or should we jump into our delivery?
Was there any tree retention that had to be on that huge parcel? They didn't have to save anything?
They may. Typically, on a commercial multifamily site, we look at prioritizing the setbacks and in required landscaped areas. Just looking at the aerial, I'm not sure there's a lot of trees on the north side of the site, which would be probably the emphasis area.
Is there any
pedestrian
pathway through the project or any corridors?
No, not that I know of. I think the distance, the north-south distance, is short enough that there wasn't any mention of that. I mean, that could be. It does look like they're kind of proposing something
in the back.
Yeah, in the back.
30-foot buffer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Survey shows few to none that would be.
Yeah. Most of the larger trees are right in the center of the site.
Mm-hmm. Are any of these in the center where you're proposing that open space? Are any of those significant?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
We will get the tree plan with the design response conference application, so we can include that in the packet.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thoughts, deliberations? Is there any public here that has any questions or comments for the applicant or the board? Seeing none, let's move into deliberation.
Well, I'll say a few things. I like configuration C, the screening, the parking. The parking is partially obscured, and it's less massive along 131st Street. 132nd must be a PUD on the Redmond side with all the trees and everything, but there's still going to be that long side, and particularly the north side. While the project pulls back 30 feet instead of the required 15, I think, there's still a challenge for that 300-foot long structure, and the significant notches in the northeast and northwest corner, you know, are a start of helping with that, and significant notches elsewhere in the structure proposed. I think it's going to be, so there's a challenge in that north boundary, and I'd certainly like to see more of how that's going to fit into the neighborhood because of the fall, the terrain. It's going to present a pretty massive wall. Between the two commercial buildings, I think there's an opportunity there to do something really nice. I don't know quite what it is, but I'll look forward to seeing what will come about. So I guess that's it.
Okay.
So. I have a couple concerns on it. I actually think it's an admirable project. There are a few, and I do have to say, even though option one is not viable, it's nice to see that there were three options there. I would like at least a presentation once where we get three viable options, but it was better than the last couple that we've had come before us. Okay, my concerns are the presentation on 85th is, you know, one of the most important things that I think this project is, and I think the board is probably going to hammer on. I have concerns with this very low level and then a very high level behind it. And I also have concerns with two buildings, this giant opening. I almost think 75 feet is too much, unless they have huge trees or something, because it looks like a driveway to me. And even if it's pavers and lawn, it still looks like this is what we were trying to avoid in the design guidelines. And I also have concerns that this is going to become leasing office, gym, just like we've had on a lot of the other projects. You know, the intent was retail or, you know, commercial, that it activates 85th. The big opening doesn't activate. Yes, it is pedestrian friendly, but I think the intent was having something to graciously enter your project for pedestrians. I think because of the lot coverage, we're getting shortchanged. So that's a concern for me. Also, if this is a gateway, the way the buildings currently mend don't work. There is a disconnect between, especially at that corner where the buildings, they don't talk to each other right now. And I know it's in concept, but if the concept's not quite right, it's not gonna, I don't see how it's gonna come together even working it. So that is a major concern. I want to see that the buildings talk to each other. They're so disjointed right now. You know, having this out front and then, you know, the residential behind. I would like to see a way too that the parking, I hate having the parking the way it is. That's a concern for me. I think the way the guidelines were written and using a situation where parking in that option three, that was for a completely different setup. That's not to be used here. I wish the parking were hidden. I wish they found a way to actually get it so that it wasn't surface parking. It just seems like for a project of this caliber, it should have either been underground or hidden. I also have concerns about the long facade on 132nd. you know, at least with the driveway entering on 131st, we have a shorter building. That's an awful long building there. So I think we should look at that. And then I don't know if we're being the, it's nice to have the 30-foot buffer, but if you look at the diagram, those houses are going to be dwarfed behind those buildings. So that's, I guess, I'm not negative on the project. I think it's actually very admirable, but I think those are the concerns that I have about the project in concept phase.
Yeah, I agree with Scott and most of the points. I think there's just something about the scale that just feels in reverse to me, with the low scale and all the open space on 85th and the long building on the back. I think that there could be ways to, you know, understand they want to keep it all contiguous for cores and circulation, but it seems like they could kind of reorganize the footprint so that there were some glassy links or something, some breaks where the building really narrows down and appears like multiple buildings instead of one across the back. Your point about the 74 feet, I mean, that's wider than a right-of-way. We come in there and then we transition to 137 feet, which is really, really wide in here. And mm-hmm. It's going to be hard for that space to feel like it has any boundary or sense of enclosure. It's hard to imagine how it will be landscaped. So yeah, I feel like there's a way to carve out this back bar somehow and get their area in. And then I'm really concerned about this transition. I feel like the residential building should just break away entirely. I don't think pulling it over the top is going to help. I think it's just going to cause this to appear flat. So, and then as far as the corners go, I mean, the sketch and the guidelines is fine, but I wouldn't just repeat it. We're looking for something that's it's an odd proportion for such a skinny and long building. So I think there's something else to do there. So.
The option we didn't see, Scott's right, which, you know, the one that doesn't work doesn't really count. The one we didn't see is the one that would be exemplified by all of the featured projects shown on page 2, which are very urban, you know, buildings that are truly mixed-use buildings. We didn't see that option, and I think we sort of need to see that as you know, yes, the rest of 85th or some of the rest is kind of what we see on option C, the preferred one, which is that just sort of one-story, two-story, stucco-y, you know, foam build-outs and kind of give it a little character and enough room for, you know, signage and all that. I think there's an option that still isn't, that we haven't seen. I agree with all the other comments on the, if this is the preferred scheme that we say yes, go with, that melding of the southeast corner, as everybody's mentioned already, either separate it, make it work, make it, you know, yes, and it's just massing models and the coloration, you know, doesn't at all indicate, you know, any building as such, but it's still, that's just such an odd little joint that's going to have to be handled carefully. And I don't know if it was Dave or Scott mentioned, if it's not obvious how it's going to be resolved now, it's not going to get easily resolved later on. Kind of what you start with is what you end up with. Out of the schemes, if there's a way to take some of the H scheme and put it into this preferred scheme, where you do get a little bit of relief for those people on the north property line, you know, if we're 30 feet back to the two, you know, jut outs of the H, and then we get an actual north courtyard, which may not be hugely usable because it's in the shade a lot, but it still is a little bit of relief. Is there a way to take some of that H-ness and put it into the option C? The entry court is huge, you know, for just you keep walking, 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 you get past the second set of parking stalls and you're still quite a huge distance, and it may not need to be that big by pulling that part of the court southward. And, you know,
I think that's what I was after, just too much open space on the south.
On the the south courtyard would be pretty nice. I mean, it would get sun, it would get a lot of it gets a little bit more noise too from 85th, where you might help quieter on the north side as well. And that 45-foot facade height on that northeast corner, that's just going to loom over. Even though it's 30 feet away, it's just going to be huge over those adjacent residences.
Yeah, I think you guys have all summed pretty well summed up all of my thoughts. You know, just echoing Scott, I do think that the project has a lot of potential. I think that they've thought through a lot of the issues on this site, but the issues that remain, to me, are very big issues. Just that disconnect between the office, commercial, and the residential, that's too awkward right now. I think that they either need to come together to become a true mixed-use project, or, as Susan said, that residential needs to be pulled away. So it's truly, you know, it's got to be all one or completely separate. Like, just abutting each other right now, there's just no harmony there. It's too much disconnect. Thinking about some of the nitty-gritty stuff about the requirements and approvals and, I guess, code requirements is, I'm still not sure that residential all along the, you know, three quarters of the site, you know, three out of the four sides, I'm not sure if that's in keeping with the code. I'm going to further dive into that. And then they, of course, say they want the 15 feet. So if we're granting one, we're granting the other. So that gives me some pause. I want to think some more about that. I'd also like to get a little bit more information on the corner kind of entry, you know, element right there at 132nd and 85th. See if there's anything specific. We've seen in some of the other codes, they call out, oh, there has to be a water feature, or there has to be some sort of community, you know, artwork or something like that. So I'm curious to see in the code what's called out there. But right now, I don't think a 45-degree, you know, Walgreens bevel in the corner of the building counts. You know, I'm not sure if that's enough to fulfill. And one of the big issues, I think, I mean, it's kind of easy to gloss over because it's in a boring section, but the fact that right now we're showing the commercial sitting 3.5 feet below the sidewalk level, I think that the code called out there has to, you know, you can go to zero lot line if there's a pedestrian walking zone or a nice pedestrian area, and there has to be connection to the commercial. Well, if you're sitting 3.5 feet below the sidewalk, there's no way you're getting that connection, which means there's no way you're getting that 0-foot lot line, which completely blows this away. Like, it's just not allowed under code.
What I was saying is that we would meet sidewalk grade at the corner if that's the appropriate place for the entrance.
Yeah, I think we're saying
yeah, but there's still 302 feet of length that we still have to meet, you know, so I just want to make sure that we're meeting, you know, the intent of the code. So that's just another concern of mine. I do think that you guys have done a good job of considering all of those elevations and, you know, thinking a lot of these things through, but these are just the issues that jump out at me. In fact, I'd be very, you know, amenable to granting a slightly higher, you know, variance, you know, if it allows them to, you know, pull over that, you know, office retail commercial space, you know, or if they need to raise the building up to be at sidewalk level. I would be more than happy to grant a variance like that over granting a variance of, like, what's presented right now, which I know is conceptual, but, you know, I...
Well, in fact, I guess I'm, other than connecting to the parking behind, I don't, there's, there's a lot of opportunity for this front commercial bar to, one, follow the track with the sidewalk grade, and two, it can have, you know, it can be taller, it can have some roof interest, it can, you know, it doesn't need, and that something that helps it blend better with the taller building behind, I think. And there's nothing that's, as far as I can tell, that's pushing that guy down.
Yeah. So in that aspect, I think the design is actually kind of timid. You know, I would be, if they came up and asked for a variance or asked for us to grant them something to make a more bolder, cohesive design between the, you know, the commercial and the residential, I would, if it helps the design, I'm all for it, rather than granting a variance just because some of the elevations are difficult to deal with, like on the grading.
I think also, too, right now I'm seeing, okay, here's our retail or commercial space, and it's so broken up. I think they have to, there's got to be something drawing them together to actually have it be, because we're thinking of pedestrian friendly is this break. No, the pedestrian is the entire sidewalk from, you know, one end of the project to the next. And I think we are creating, you know, and it's based on, okay, well, lot coverage. Well, maybe we need to give a little bit more in other areas, or find a way to, you know, decrease some of this parking, you know, maybe get some more of your parking underground, do something to make the actual retail work along 85th.
Yeah. There's opportunities to do that, I think. And then one other last thing, talking about kind of some of these minor grading things. If you guys take a look at the east-west section, on that bottom left, you'll see an overhang for the residential units, and there's about 3 feet, I think, of concrete that's parking garage. That'll run along, I think, the whole length of 132nd. And that's, I mean, I know it's set back from the street 20 feet, you know, but I don't like the idea of having a 3 foot band of concrete, you know, even if there's undulation and other materials up high, you know, sure, some plantings can cover it, but I just think that there's, you know, that's a detail that, you know, needs to be thought out in conceptual before it gets too far down the road.
Either concrete or else openings. So you see the cars.
Yeah, and again, that goes back to, you know, they wanted commercial on the ground floor, and now we're not just allowing, and they wanted 15 feet, and now we're not just allowing that, but we're also allowing just like a parking garage blank wall. So I don't want to get, I wanted to highlight that now before we got too far along. So I'm definitely going to take a closer look at the Rose Hill, you know, code, the zoning code myself to make sure that we're meeting the intent. But that sums up most all of my thoughts on it. So, can we get constructive criticism and comments? What would we like to see, you know, for next meeting?
Well, I think we'd like to see a rethinking of the 85th frontage, the scale of those buildings, their relationship to the street. We'd like to see.
Yes, wait, Jeremy. Is it that vague where it just says it has to be pedestrian friendly? What? Okay.
It's not expansive. It's not like some of the other pedestrian-oriented design guidelines, because it's a small subset, small sub-area of a bigger design district. But we can send you a link to the whole document.
Okay. Well, maybe point out what district pieces we should be applying to this site, since it was added later.
Yep.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Also for city gateways.
Yeah.
yeah, it's in there. It's the, like the, for this site, it's kind of a gateway, and then also you got the street corner. So there's kind of two separate sections within the design guidelines to address that.
I don't want to get into other parts of those that don't apply here either, so just understanding better what's specific. Anyway, 85th frontage, better resolution of the taller building to the low building.
I would like a better resolution to this parking. Mm-hmm. That probably is my number one issue on this project is...
That would solve a lot of the other...
Yeah, it's just the
I think the applicant's pretty clear they want kind of a suburban approach to the commercial spaces where you park and have minimal distance to go. There's no grade, there's no elevators, there's no stairs, there's nothing to get from structured parking to, you know, those commercial spaces, which you see in typical mixed-use urban projects now. I mean, we're the other end of Rose Hill. We've had a conceptual conference on the one there at Petco where it's an odd combination, but there is lots and lots of structured parking for the commercial spaces. And I think, Susan, you mentioned that this is sort of the first domino of what eventually could happen along a lot of 85th. And do we say, yeah, just keep it sort of the suburban feel, even though the parking is, the on-grade parking is kind of hidden. You know, even if they neck the two buildings closer to each other, is that what we want to say? Is that, yeah, just, you know, do it this way and everybody else eventually redevelops accordingly. I agree with you. I think it'd be nice to see something else, but I don't know if we can ask, but we can't.
The other thing, I really want to see some very clear breaks in big building. Yeah. We've been struggling with these, and in this context, when it's so low, I feel like it's just gonna have a really odd scale to it, and I think the neighborhood is not gonna be pleased with that north side. Mm-hmm. Actually, or the east or the west, to be honest, especially the east.
The west, at least, because it's of the driveway, break. it has a break.
It breaks it down, yeah. But it looks like there's a blank wall on that side, though.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I mean, the vast majority of people are going to be viewing this on 132nd. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be a long...
If something else, think about, you know, 132nd, 131st, if the traffic really is that I actually don't go up 132nd, during rush hour, you guys know, if it is that backed up, is 131st going to be the de facto primary driveway for the project? And should we then kind of design it or consider it as such?
If one of the tenants wants to go eastbound into Redmond, coming out of 131st, you face a difficult left turn into the already clogged up left turn lane that's going there. So if somebody says, no, I need to go eastbound on, you know, 85th, they're going to go out the 132nd side, try their luck, and get into the left turn lane there. But because my recollection is 131st just bends and dead ends into a cul-de-sac. It doesn't connect through to anything, I don't think.
Okay. Right. Okay.
But it certainly.
Pardon? Yeah.
It is dead.
Yeah. No, I'm just not familiar with rush hour on 132nd and how bad it is. So.
Like most of the city, it's pretty substantial. Yeah. Do we get a sense, the board, that we're approving a concept here and sending them into? No. Okay.
Yeah, if we're talking about, you know, working on the connection between the commercial and the residential and reworking the parking, you know, those are... I think big enough factors. Yeah.
Okay, I agree. I just wanted to take the temperature.
I hate to say it, but I would like to see a little more mixed use.
Well, I'm concerned that it's, you know, office instead of retail. They're talking about, you know, pedestrian if it's just going to be, you know, I don't know, 60 people maybe, if it's fully leased out in those two buildings, it's not going to be a whole lot of pedestrian activation along 85th, which I think defeats the purpose of a lot of the intent of the code. But we can't dictate that it be retail. That also retail ups the parking count, you know, which I'm sure they don't like, you know.
Yeah.
I don't like to see it as office.
I think there's some diagrams in the guidelines we'll send you. This end of the corridor was envisioned as certainly more suburban. There's a theme there from the Lee Johnson's end of the corridor down to the east end of the corridor that it's tapering out. The scale of buildings is smaller. The mixed use is less intensive
than
mixed
over.
Use. It's
from here east, it's through when you get to Redlands. Mm-hmm,
right.
Yep.
So it's certainly nothing that I think that was envisioned in that development of the design guidelines and the neighborhood plans as being a really vibrant mixed use center. But it was important to the neighborhood to have the opportunities for shops and services that were
yeah.
a neighborhood scale.
Still have that gateway element
yeah.
too as an entry to Kirkland.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think just the struggle with the office, similar to the struggle with how it meets the grade, is really more the pedestrian experience.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably the way to think about it, that if you design the buildings that can accommodate either use, but don't design the building such that it's kind of doomed to be office forever, even if there's a market for retail businesses. It's because both are allowed.
Does the applicant have any questions of the board?
Yes. Thank you. I was just going to ask if I could ask a question because I'm in different jurisdictions that have different rules.
Good evening. My name is Robert Gregg. I'm the owner's representative and the project manager, so I'm responsible for giving the architect direction. And I really appreciate a lot of your comments. And this is intended, as you know, to be kind of a massing study, and we're not quite to design review. And certainly the comments you're making about how high the commercial area could be, we'll deal with all that. My question is, you mentioned that you might be able to give some variances in exchange for helping make the project better. And as you well know, you know, we've been sitting here trying to deal with it's a bubble. You push on this, it comes out here. You've got all the things to balance that you're obviously extremely aware of. So, yes, we have been trying to keep it all within the confines. What I need to kind of get a feel for is how much give and take can we work together on to make it a better project, even though it may not 100% you know, conform to what's written. We don't need any height. Don't worry about height.
Yeah.
I'm from Edmonds. Trust me.
Yeah, it's in the guideline book. We can do it. And if you ask staff, you know, unfortunately, we can't give permission that's not in our power.
That's why I'm specifically asking. For example, if the buildings, the space between the two retail/commercial areas to be determined still, if that's to get smaller because the buildings get bigger, that would need a little bit of a variance over the 70% coverage, but could make a better project.
If they allow it.
Yeah, right now the only things in the Rose Hill Business District that can be modified are the required yards and the landscape buffer. So anything else would, you know, I guess it could be rolled up into a planned unit development proposal or something like that, but the board wouldn't have the ability to modify the lot coverage,
yeah,
that kind of thing.
As a developer, we need to try to avoid that level of request.
Yeah.
But you are doing a planned unit development, right, to do what we're seeing?
Well, that's right now that's the mechanism that would have to be used to do that, and how that, you know, and so if it was, you know, if they're through the design review process, they wanted to, you know, hey, we need to increase the lot coverage to meet this, that would be, could be something they could propose as part of the planned unit development later.
And then it would come back to us as a minor modification, or question.
I mean, you'd be approving the project and all. You'd be approving the project in whatever its desired form was. So it'd be more if the PUD didn't get approved and required design changes, and then you'd see it again within its altered state.
Yeah.
And trying to address your issue about commercial versus retail, we fight with the same thing in downtown Edmonds. I mean, we've actually even written code down there requiring certain districts to be retail, which doesn't work sometimes. But the parking that we're trying to hide behind it, because of the elevation change on this, any hope for that to be retail would really be hurt by having to have people drive, 300 feet down 131st or 2nd, go into a garage, try to figure out how to walk back the 300 feet and find an elevator and come up. All the businesses along 85th there right now are pull in, do it, and leave. So that wasn't really a question. That was more of a comment. But.
Yeah, and I think our only, our dilemma there is the pedestrian friendly image.
Right. But you did make a comment about how would that courtyard be done if we can't make the buildings either bring them closer or make them longer. Believe me, we'll put a lot of effort into the landscaping of that, because the whole idea is to have that be really attractive. And there's no intention whatsoever to use either of those buildings as the leasing office. There's a leasing office space in the building, so we want to pull the people into the courtyard. And the reason for that is because then they're right close to the elevator. So whoever's taking them around to show them units, they come into the leasing office that's in the big building, and they're right by the elevators so that they can then take them where they need to go. So those buildings, just to allow your fares there, those will be.
Now, we get a little jaded because, we do a project and what was deemed retail ends up being, the gym or the. Yeah, or something other than what the true guideline was intended for, but it fit.
Right.
And also there is something with the economics of, once a project is completed, was it leasable? So that's beyond our control sometimes. So our intent is, when we're at this stage, at least say it out in the open, what we're hoping for.
Sure. And I think that was why I was making that comment, because it's always a push. If we do away with the parking there to hide it, you completely destroy any option of making that retail. We have no idea who we're going to lease that to. And would, frankly, we get more money out of retail, so if we can get them in there, that'd be great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was my thank you very much for your
thank
help.
Thank you.
These guys slid and we ended up with sort of these three broader nodes along there or something. I mean, I think something like that could help this scale and rhythm and help this proportion here. I don't know. So, maybe you guys look at sliding these bars. Maybe this doesn't need to be a corner entry. Maybe the corner element is a corner open space. And the same here, and we slide over and kind of redistribute this.
Mm-hmm.
That might help the scale along there.
And hide the parking a little better, too.
And give the pedestrian a more sense of connection so that you're not having to cross the street in the middle, essentially.
And I do think we have more opportunity to modulate that noise.
Okay, I would say that we don't bog them down, though, and say come back with three more.
No. I didn't mean that. I just feel like we're not
no,
ready
but
to
I mean,
the concept.
I would say progress with what they're...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's plenty of opportunity in their preferred scheme, to revise, and modulate to get something that we can move forward with. I don't think that we need to require three more schemes.
I agree.
But am I hearing the board ask to come back for a follow-up conceptual conference before going to design response conference?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we need a continuation then?
No, you don't.
We don't for that. Okay.
It's not. We don't notice that.
Just meeting, for the.
So can, we can come back whenever they're
okay.
Ready.
Okay.
Do we have to schedule it tonight, or do they?
It is
no,
not.
We can just.
We can tell them when there's opening.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. We can. Yeah, whenever they're ready, they can schedule. Yeah.
Open meetings. There's really not much else other than Aegis on the agenda between now and the end of the year.
All right. Well, if we don't have to schedule it now, I suppose we can entertain motion to adjourn.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Meeting is adjourned. Meeting is adjourned.